Chapter 41. Adam and Emma sat facing each other, straddling a bench at the back of the dining hall, illuminated by one small amber light flickering on the table like a candle. At their feet were the two mattresses they had pulled in from the bunk room and laid side by side. They were tired, but reluctant to sleep. "Well, this is it," she told him. "I guess it is. One way or another, tomorrow everything changes." She slid closer so their knees touched. "I want to thank you for everything." He smiled and moved a stray lock of hair from her face. "For the privilege of loving you? It's been my deepest pleasure. Are we saying goodbye?" "Yes. Yes, we are, just in case. Thank you for being my best friend and giving me countless moments of joy."
That's all a life is. Individual moments strung together. So many of them good, because of you.
We all get an unknown number of moments. Those we can control, we use for good or ill until we have no more. We've used ours well.
"Emma, I have no regrets. Nothing is missing. If we're separated tomorrow in any way, know that this life we shared was more than enough. Now come here."
She turned around and fit into the curve of his body, her legs along the bench. He enveloped her with his arms and put his lips to her neck. They stayed there for a long while in silence. She could feel his heart beating against her body until she did not know which was her own. And then she rose, grabbed his hand, and pulled him down to their makeshift bed. At that moment, across the yard of dust, through the boundary of the threads and deep within the tangled hallways of Ellis, Andre was pacing the hallways. He was anxious because he could feel that things had changed, but he did not know how. He felt the ripples of an event that had not yet occurred, and he knew he was peripherally a part of it and partly a cause of it. Things were unbearable and could not be sustained. He knew that. Sovereign was losing his mind, and he had recognized the growing danger for a long time. How had he let it go this long? He had hoped that someone else would step up, and he felt ashamed. But Sovereign had everything so sewn up, it was impossible to get a foothold against him. Well, perhaps not impossible. Andre had stood in the darkness months before and watched Emma Jones hold a knife to him. He had failed to respond as Sovereign's protector, hoping that she would kill him and free him from this nightmarish servitude. He wondered if the others felt the same way. They were all in fear, even in fear of each other. Suddenly, a bare arm shot out from a recessed doorway and pulled Andre in. He saw that it was Laurel and lowered the shaking fist that had recoiled ready to strike by instinct. Her heart was pounding as she stood on her toes and whispered in his ear, "I need you to do something for me. It has to be tonight." Later, Adam awoke in the darkness of the empty dining hall, surprised that he had slept at all. He had no idea what time it was, but it felt like it could be nearing morning. He turned to look at Emma, who was turned towards him, sleeping quietly, her lips slightly parted, her hand on his bare chest. He doubted he would sleep again, though he wanted to. There was just too much at stake, and yet there was nothing he could do right now. If he got up, he might awaken Joy and Tam and the men. He closed his eyes and tried to empty his mind of all thoughts. He relaxed his muscles, starting at the toes and working all the way up his body, feeling his weight against the mattress. He breathed deeply, and suddenly, he was back in his old familiar dream, fascinated by the thistles and birds and swooping lines that adorned the blue and green tiles lining the walls at the top of the huge marble staircase. The colored light streamed through enormous stained glass windows and across the floor and shifted with the slow movement of clouds across the sky. He was entranced by the beauty of it all, but overwhelmed by the scale, and he reached for the dust floating in the beam of light. And then he heard his name again in a whisper.
He wanted to be left alone in his focus, but something in the voice made him turn. And there was the woman, calling to him, with a smile on her face, but fear in her eyes. And he loved her, this woman. And he went to her quickly, to be swept away in her arms. Adam woke with a start and sat up, shaking his head and trying to catch his breath. Emma sat up in alarm and confusion. "Adam, what is it? Are you okay?" He did not answer her, but he threw the blanket back and crawled up from the bed, almost tripping as he stepped into his pants, and ran from the room. Emma followed him, calling his name. He ran straight to Joy's room and hit the door so hard it flew back and hit the wall violently. Emma, a few paces behind, saw Tam calmly turning over his cards at the kitchen table. He looked up placidly. She shrugged at him and motioned for him to come. Joy's room was illuminated by gentle golden light through the mica shade on her little table lamp. She was pulling herself up and swinging her legs over the side of her bed, still tangled in her sheets, her white hair floating from her head like electricity. Adam fell to his knees at her feet. "Did you call me?" he whispered. She smiled down at him. Adam reached his trembling hands towards her and gently pushed the wrinkled, sagging skin back from her cheeks so he could see the face she might have had long ago. "You called me. I remember." Tam stood in the doorway beside Omar, who had heard the commotion and come in from the bunk room. Emma leaned against the wall, confused but unwilling to disturb the import of the moment. Joy nodded. "Yes, sweetheart. I called you, and you came, just in time. Do you remember who I am?" "You are Sandy." She put her hand on his cheek and nodded. "Good, darling. And do you remember who you are?" "I am Asa." She kissed him on the forehead. He felt a flood of fear and loss. "What happened? Why were we there? Please tell me, now, quickly. I can't bear this confusion. Am I awake? Is this a dream?" His voice shook. He felt barely in control. The old woman fluffed her pillow and placed it against the wall, moving back so she could lean against it. She patted the bed beside her, and Adam moved to join her. "It's no dream. Come, all of you, come sit with me and I'll tell you the story. I am Sandra Sovereign. My life with my Seth and Joni, it was beautiful and natural, I always thought. Our lives were woven together like a fine fabric. My brother, he was simply an extension of myself. I didn't perceive myself as a separate person. My identity included him. Every thought included his perspectives and desires, and his thoughts included mine. It was effortless. It was simply the way it was. The three of us were inseparable, and we spent little time with anyone else, mostly Tam and Dad. We were absorbed curating and preserving the great artwork of the world. Our father did such a beautiful job designing Abacus. The system had a beautiful synergy. It was greater than all of us, and it did not rely on our intervention, so we were able to immerse ourselves in art. I know this is terribly obvious, but it took me a long time to figure out we were the only people in all of Abacus who were siblings. Nobody seemed to think of this. We didn't think we were odd at all. Nobody ever pointed it out. We were just three more people who lived here. It was a few years before the occasional baby started being born in Abacus, and nobody had more than one, so we really were unique. Seth, he was not abridged. He was the smaller, weaker twin. He had some distress when he was born, and my parents decided he was too frail for the procedure until he grew bigger and stronger. He did grow bigger and stronger, but it seemed they'd forgotten. On purpose or not, we'll never know. The procedure was never done. The people who came here were so open and so practical, they forgot to bring their taboos with them. So when I became pregnant by Seth, we were unprepared for the horror that met us, at what we thought was a joyful thing. We were not children at the time. I think we were approaching 40 years old. We weren't in the practice of sleeping together. It happened a few times through the years. We had no idea it was wrong. Not a clue. We had always thought we fit together like two pieces of a puzzle. Our father was so damaged by this turn of events. It almost killed me, his self-recrimination. He left Abacus over it. Left Abacus! Oh, those were tough times. We tried to carry on with the same joy we'd felt at first, but it was nearly impossible. We could not unknow the wrongness of what we had done. We could not undo it, either. It was always there, hanging over us, this oppressive cloud of disapproval and shame. Shame was a new feeling. Horrible. Horrible. When our son was born, I was filled with joy, despite the circumstances. I loved him as any mother would love a child. He became my whole world. I nursed him and cuddled him and I sang to him, but he didn't respond like I thought he would. He didn't care to hold my eye. He looked at me with the same disapproval I felt from everyone else. And poor Joni. She loved Seth as much as I did, or maybe more, because she was a separate person and could love him more voluntarily than I could. She wished the child were hers. She was like a second mother to him, but he was as indifferent to her as he was to me. We named him Starling, because when we were little, we thought our freckles looked like stars scattered across the sky, and we called ourselves Star People. He wouldn't answer to his name. Seth grew sad as Starling grew older. I think he felt responsible, as our father had. Although what happened between us was consensual, as ordained by our biology, it was he who entered me. And the demeanor of our child felt like a constant reproach. The only time Starling seemed happy was when he was causing someone else pain or discomfort. We tried to socialize him with other children, and he would terrorize them in ingenious and cruel ways. People were so confused that no one born in Abacus could comprehend his behavior. They actually questioned themselves as if they were the ones doing something wrong, and they would apologize to him as he took advantage of them. When we tried to discipline him, he would laugh. It was all so terribly sad, so isolating. We did the best we could. We stayed close to home. I tried everything to reach him, but his brain, it just didn't work like mine. Nothing I tried worked. Long and difficult years went by, and he did what he wanted, and we tried to minimize the damage. We learned not to speak of what we cared about in Starling's presence, because if we did, he would look for an opportunity to destroy it. We lost some beautiful, historic artwork that way. And then something incredible happened. Starling was around 11 years old, and Joni became pregnant by Seth. They'd been a couple for a long time, but I didn't know she could conceive at that age. She was so happy. We all were, except Starling. His rage and cruelty were unquenchable, but he was powerless. They had a beautiful baby boy. She named him John Asa Sovereign, after her adoptive father and the biological father she never knew, Asa Wade Baker. You are that child, Asa. We all adored you so. Starling was so resentful. We had to watch him constantly and never leave you alone with him. And then when you were only 3 years old, Tam came to us with big news. The outside, it was ready for us. A whole clean, fresh world made new again for us to move into. Tam and his people had cleaned the world in less than 60 years, and thanks to them and my father, Nearly 15,000 human beings had survived. We were so excited, so grateful, so hopeful. We wept. All but Starling. He was furious. He demanded to know when it was going to be his turn to rule Abacus. We tried to explain that there was no ruler of Abacus, but it only made him more angry. He told us people were stupid and things would be different when he was in charge. Tam wanted to take us out and show us the new world before we alerted the people and shut down Abacus for good. Much to our surprise, Starling's behavior abruptly changed. He was actually excited for the trip and cooperative. It was a shocking and a very welcome relief. And so we all went. Me and Seth and Joni, you and Starling and Tam. Scheiße, it was beautiful. It was the world of 300 years ago. You can't comprehend the freshness of the air. The crispness of the colors, if you haven't seen it, and the primal reaction that it inspires. There were birds and animals, yes, real birds and animals alive, everywhere. Tam and his people had worked with my father to secure DNA from samples saved from the Smithsonian and other museums and research facilities. They had carefully researched the flora and the fauna of various regions of the Earth before human involvement, and they brought it all back. The oceans, they were clear and overflowing with life. Radioactive materials had been moved off planet or neutralized. Even the microorganisms were tailored for wellness and reintroduced. Most of the buildings were cleared away, but they had restored some of the most exquisite. Tam took us to a building more beautiful than I had ever seen. It was stunning with a huge double marble staircase, tiled arches and domes of stained glass. The light, it was purer than that of Abacus, and as it shone through the glass, it created poignant, moving designs across the walls and the floor and on our faces and our arms. It made you laugh so, Asa. We wandered around in awe, and Tam told me that these buildings had helped him to understand the best of humankind. And you were fascinated, too, even though you were a small child. I loved watching you explore everything up close, touching the ridges of the tiled walls and staring intently at the colors. You took a long time everywhere we went, so we ended up in two groups, with Starling going off to explore with Seth and Joni, and you staying with me and Tam. It was the most exciting day of my life, until it became the most tragic. I was carried away with thoughts of our emigration from Abacus and the freedom of the people to start over with this exciting, verdant planet filled with life. We stood by the secondary stairs behind an open arch doorway, and I looked up into the stairwell at the railing as it coiled around the upper floors like a nautilus lit from above by a skylight. You walked along the Greek key pattern in the mosaic floor as if it were a maze, but stopped a safe distance from the top of the grand staircase that overlooked the concourse, so I let you explore. I will never forget this moment as long as I live, because it was only the second time I was taken from a state of focused joy to a state of abject horror in a split second. We heard a scuffle from a level above, across on the other side. There was nothing to absorb the sound in this empty building of stone and glass. Everything was exaggerated. I looked up to see my brother's body falling to the floor below. He must have already been unconscious because he did not make a sound. He fell as a passive object, and that sickening sound when he struck that beautiful marble floor is burned into my memory forever. I felt like everything froze in that moment. I moved to run to him, or to run to Joni and my son, but Tam grabbed my arm. Within seconds, Joni was falling too, like the birds that fell during the great poisoning, falling out of the sky. And I saw Starling's head looking over the edge down at what he had done, and he laughed. Through my shock, I realized then what had happened and that we were all in danger. I called to you, and you came. We stole down the side stairs and circled around the wall of the lobby to a back exit that Tam knew of. Starling was calling to me in a calm and pleasant voice as if he wanted to show me some beautiful feature he had discovered, and I thought he would hear my ragged breaths, but he did not. As we passed through, I saw their bodies, twisted and entwined like discarded rag dolls as the plume of blood bloomed around them. There was nothing, nothing to be done for them. The reality of that moment did not sink in until much later. It was a part of myself lying on that cold and intricate floor. Seth and Joni had lost everything, but at least they didn't have to try to exist as partial people. All we could do was slip away. We knew now what Starling was capable of. The building that we had been exploring was not far from the main gate of Abacus, no more than a kilometer or so. Tam and his people had relocated it there as a gift for all of us, to stand as a symbol of what acts of beauty we were capable of. We hid out for a few days, which is not easy with a heartbroken 3-year-old. You ached for your mother and father, and I could not pretend that I did not also. Tam's people supplied us with food, but they were uneasy about interfering with our drama, and some were concerned that Tam was overstepping his bounds. They felt they had more than fulfilled their obligations to us, and they wanted to disentangle themselves from further human ugliness. They pressured Tam to leave, but he could not. He felt he had failed to keep his promise to John Sovereign, and now 2 of the 3 children that he had sworn to protect lay desecrated on that mosaic floor, staining with blood that message of potential beauty with one of potential violence. There was no way he would leave me. He was my sworn protector. We could not stay out there. We knew we were not prepared to live in the wilderness of the new world by ourselves. There were insects and animals we were not familiar with. And so Tam hid us away and approached the door by which we had left Abacus only a few days before. Sandra paused and nodded to Tam. You were there, Tam. Tell them what happened next. Everything was as Sandra says. Back at the door, there was a package waiting. It contained a screen with a message that Starling was now the leader of Abacus and he was only to be addressed as Sovereign. If we wanted to negotiate a surrender, we should respond to the message and wait at the door. There was no viable alternative. Before long, the door was opened and an unknown person led the way to Starling. He already sat in a historic throne that he had pulled from the art warehouse and installed in the grand upper lobby of Ellis. He looked like a child playing dress-up. But he was not playing. He had planned and manipulated since he learned Abacus was to close. He had spun a web of lies that Asa was actually an outlier's child and that there was a secret plan for some select few humans to interbreed with outliers, and those people would repopulate the earth. He had convinced the people that they were in grave danger, and they were willing to support his rule because he promised safety. Starling, Sovereign, asked me what we wanted. All we wanted was for Sandra to be allowed to live. We did not dare to trust Asa's life to him. He was led to believe that we had been separated from Asa when running from the building and had assumed Sovereign had him. He responded that he had found Asa dead at the bottom of the stairs and had thrown his body on a heap with his parents. He did not flinch when telling this lie. Perhaps he believed it. He said he would barter Sandra's life for something he wanted, the Ushan mines. It was astounding. He needed to be made to understand what that would mean to the world that had been renewed. But he more than didn't care. It was what he wanted, to keep people prisoner there, under his rule. He was not concerned about what was right or true or healthy or even sane. It did not matter what words were spoken. He could not be reasoned with. The alternate reality that he had created in his head, despite its deviation from fact and reason, was the template that would determine the fates of everyone under his jurisdiction. The bargain was made because there was no other way out right then. We agreed that the outliers would set up the mines and provide a liaison to oversee them. In exchange, Sandra could live. But, of course, he had conditions. We had to live outside Abacus in the mine housing that we were to create. We could never reveal to anyone who we were or that the mines existed. He claimed he was removing Sandra's chip from the interior grid and destroying it so she could never re-enter Abacus. It was terribly, terribly defeating. My people were stunned at the agreement and very reluctant to participate. We did not want to be beholden to this destructive madman. Through much discussion, we were able to build a consensus, and only because they understood the desperate choices involved. But there was always to be a time limit. Returning to Sandra and explaining the situation to her was very painful. Her only concern was for you, Asa. And that night, you were bundled tightly and your sleepy head was pressed right here, he patted his chest. And we passed through the threads to take you to safety in Abacus. To see Sandra give up the last member of her family so you could be safe, it was the moment the beauty and the strength of your people shone most brightly. As we left, she told him his new name was Adam Jones. Adam, from the ancient story of the first child in the New World, and Jones, because you were Jones' child. We went in the dark to the home of your new father, who had been a peacemaker in the old world, and someone for whom John had great respect. He took you instantly and without reservation and kept your story secret for the rest of his life. Sovereign did not discover you were alive until he orchestrated the obliteration of Adam Jones. The threads called out your true name, and so Julian had to go too, because he had witnessed it. So now we are here. We have waited many years to tell our story. In order to be true to our agreements, we could not tell anyone who we were, but we had to wait for someone else to reveal our identities. Omar discovered Tirfa Alman, and when Asa remembered Sandra, we were freed. They sat in silence for a moment. It occurs to me that you have all been orphaned by Sovereign, said Tam. It is poetic, in a way, that you three are the ones to set things right. I guess, in a way, even Sandra was, added Omar. Sandra placed her hand on Omar's knee and looked at him kindly. It was not Starling's fault that he was brought into being. He came into the world damaged somehow. He is, I am sure, filled with a lifelong misery and discomfort and has no idea why. He deserves our pity. My father's decision to leave Abacus was not Starling's fault. She patted him and began to move towards the edge of the bed. That being said, she pulled herself to her feet, he has proven to be toxic both in and out of Abacus. He's got to go,